This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, the race for president 2016 begins. Just kidding. There's still plenty to discuss about how Barack Obama pulled it off in 2012.
We remain more than a collection of red states and blue states. We are and forever will be the United States of America.
Also, how pot and gay marriage won at the ballot box. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, Disney buys Star Wars. Will the studio revive or ruin the beloved franchise? Also, in praise of the Twitter hashtag, insert pound sign here. And finally, the new movie Flight. Does it soar or never quite get off the ground?
The way you landed that plane was nothing short of a miracle.
We're gonna roll it.
What do you mean, roll it?
Ready? Here we go.
We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. Joining me are Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And from New York is Slate's senior editor, Emily Bazelon. Hello, Emily.
Hi, David.
So, first of all, I owe everyone an apology. I was wrong. I thought that Mitt Romney was going to win the presidency, and I owe you all an apology. And as a,
I don't know why that's. Why do you owe people an apology?
Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, your point was basically the economy is really bad and it's hard for a president, based on history, based on the numbers, based on what people were saying, all of that data, real data, you were trying to make, you made a reasonable assumption that, it would be a problem for him.
Thank you, John.
Wasn't the only issue in the campaign, so there was other things going on, but it wasn't like it was crazy for him.
I don't know why
that.
John's being nice to me. I don't like it. Okay, so we have no shortage of topics this week. Of course, we'll talk about President Obama's victory, and we'll discuss some of the key social issues fought out at the ballot box this week, notably pot and gay marriage. You may have heard President Obama won re-election this week with surprising ease, confounding conservatives, but not Nate Silver. He won all the swing states except North Carolina. He captured a popular vote majority. Let's listen.
Nate Silver won all the swing states.
Nate Silver also won a popular vote
Actually,
majority.
Basically.
Let's listen to Nate Silver's acceptance speech. No, let's listen to President Obama talk about his victory.
It doesn't matter who you are or where you come from or what you look like or where you love. It doesn't matter whether you're black or white or Hispanic or Asian or Native American or young or old or rich or poor, able, disabled, gay or straight. You can make it here in America if you're willing to try.
So Democrats also grabbed Senate seats. They had little business winning in Indiana, sort of in Missouri, thanks to the Republicans running foot-and-mouth candidates. And they also took most of the other competitive Senate races as well, except Nevada's, right, John?
That's Nevada.
Except Nevada's. And Republicans, of course, held their majority in the House of Representatives, setting us up for a political system that is at least superficially unchanged from what we have today. So how did President Obama win? There are a bunch of theories. I will just lay them out, and then you guys can shoot them all down. So one, there was a epically bad candidate in Mitt Romney. Two, there was an increasingly diverse electorate that, except for white voters, was turned off by the Republican Party. Three, there was superior Democratic strategy and tactics, especially at mobilizing and turning out voters. Four, a Republican Party that offered nothing much in the way of new ideas and a lot of old ideas that most Americans aren't keen on. So, Emily, what is your favorite theory about why President Obama won and won pretty easily?
Well, all of the above. But the data I've been really struck by is the demographic data. We're showing this rise in the minority population, and it's not like an enormous change from 2008, but President Obama got fewer white votes than he did the last time around, in fact, fewer than Mike Dukakis. But he was able to win because he had such the lion's share of support among Hispanic and Asian and African American voters. And I think there's a wake-up call here for the Republican Party. The demographics, age-wise, are going against them. And so the most interesting thing to me about this election is how the party reacts to that wake-up call. And I don't think that there's just this simple, okay, now we have to do immigration reform, and that's going to address the whole thing. It's really a broader critique or set of challenges about how to make those people feel like they can identify as Republicans, or at least that a Republican presidential candidate has something concrete to offer them.
And also in Ohio, he had an economic argument to make. It was so he did well arguing two things on the economic front in Ohio in particular, which was A, that I delivered the auto bailout, which saved jobs, and B, that Mitt Romney is the embodiment of all the things that caused the economic downturn. He's an outsourcer, he's an offshorer, and he's comes from this esoteric world of finance. He's basically a Wall Street guy, even though technically he obviously never worked on Wall Street. So that double punch helped him with white voters in Ohio on the question of who cares about you, who's going to be fighting for you, whose policies are tilted more towards you and not towards the rich.
Emily, so obviously the other big story that people are telling about this particular campaign of President Obama's is that it was just tactically brilliant, that they had more expertise, they used data better, they brought in all these behavioral psychologists to understand how voters would respond to various things. They A-B tested everything. So each one of those irritating emails that Obama donors would get from the president, with some with a subject line, hello, some with the subject line, I'm desperate to spend the night with you. They're testing to see, you know, which one of those really provokes some more donations or more response. Obviously, Sasha Eisenberg, our colleague, chronicled a lot of this in the Victory Lab, and he talked about this on the GabFest some weeks ago. What is it in what the Democrats did that is so amazing? And is that something that the GOP just needs to – can they just repeat it on their own? Is it will it be a problem for them to steal that for 2016?
Well, it seems like they could repeat it. It's technical. It's about road testing and combining the micro-targeting data where you figure out exactly which attributes of a voter make them more likely to vote for you with what you were just talking about, which is then field testing everything. What Sasha talks about, though, that could be a longer-term setback for the Republicans is that there are so many political scientists and grad students in this area who are Democrats who've kind of signed on, and that's helped give the Democrats like a brain advantage. So the Republicans, it seems like, need to address that in their next time out. But I would expect them to catch up in the same way how after 2004, when Bush did all of the first micro-targeting, the Democrats got up.
Well, it's a challenge now because what happened in the Republican Party is they did all of this in 2004, and then the institutional knowledge was lost, in part because the Republican Party fell apart under Michael Steele, and also because a lot of it was connected to the candidate. And that'll be true with Democrats. A lot of this genius was made possible because of people's connection to Barack Obama. And also, you have the people who ran the show. What made the Obama strategist so good was not just that they had the right model. It's that they were just basically relentless in dealing with the day-to-day little tiny things that you had to do. And here's one little example. They boasted about the number of offices they had, and Republicans would scoff and say, oh, you know, this is just real estate bragging. No, there was a theory behind it, which was if I have an office in my neighborhood and there's somebody you know and recognize from the neighborhood or who looks like you and who has common experiences with you, you're more likely to engage in a conversation with them and find an affinity for the candidate they support based on your common cultural attachments to the world. And that's why you want a neighborhood office. You want a place people can walk to and connect with that then leads them to the candidate. And that's a theory that's, you know, it's a political science sort of theory based on numbers in a sense, but there is a human element to it that they are also being really smart about.
Well, that's what I love is that this is a story. Oh, it seems to be a story about technology. Oh, it's not a story about technology. It's about a technology married to insight about human nature, namely that people want to connect with other people.
Yeah.
Face to face.
One thing we have to point out is that on the opposite side of this, the Romney campaign appears to have so grossly believed their own spin. They just refused to believe that the electorate was the shape of the electorate that it was. Their models were all that only Democrats would exceed Republicans by like 2 points. They ended up exceeding Republicans by 7 points. The reason when we had this big debate about skewing polls, all the pollsters pushed back and said, we don't pick party ideology. We let people do that. We don't. It's not like race and gender, which are fixed. Party ideology floats. And whatever it appears to be when we do our sample that is based on our methods, that's what the party ideology is of the various people. And we don't mess with that, because once you start messing with it, it's a sin against polling. Well, basically the Romney people didn't believe it, and they just basically deluded themselves. It'll be interesting in the reporting in the next couple of weeks whether they deluded themselves more than the McCain campaign did.
So, John and Emily, one big story going into the election was there's a huge amount of money in the super PACs that's being poured in. You know, here we are, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of outside spending later, And on the Republican side, zero to show for it. Nothing. Zilch. Money flushed down the toilet by Sheldon Adelson. Did that money, Emily, make a difference? And it just, you know, narrowed President Obama's margin of victory? Or was it, did it have no effect at all? Or did it make a difference? I mean, my suspicion is that probably, if we look at the House races, probably that outside spending actually did help, but that in maybe in the national campaign it didn't.
I mean, we can only look for indirect effects, right? I mean, another thesis would be that it pushed Obama to the center or to the right in some way that wouldn't have been true if that money hadn't been out there. I think you could argue that about Israel. On the other hand, it's not just Sheldon Adelson that pushes every American president to swear fealty to Israel. There are other elements as well. It does seem like, if you're thinking of this as, you know, money spent to get a candidate elected, that there was an incredible mismatch there. I do hope that they stimulated the local economies a lot with their dollars, especially in my home state of Connecticut, where Linda McMahon has now spent $100 million to lose two Senate races.
Another thing we got to figure out in the coming weeks is, and this is the big surprise for me, was that Romney appears to have underperformed McCain by like 2 million votes. And so on election night, and so this I never would have, like beating John McCain should have been like a throw rug could have done that running for the Republican nomination. So the fact that, so one theory is, and this is particularly interesting to look in the counties in Ohio, which I haven't done yet, but is that basically that this is where Obama's relentless defining of Romney worked, that he basically made Romney objectionable for rural voters in some way that benefited him. So we'll see if that ends up turning out to be true.
Mitt Romney is going to, you know, he is going to be forgotten in the way that really bad presidential candidates are forgotten, in the way Mike Dukakis has been forgotten by the Democrats. You know, history will not long remember Mitt Romney. But I would just like to pause. I continue to think that guy was, his stock is low, but he's a smart man. I think he would have been a really completely competent, capable president. And
well, one version of him would have been the version that showed up in the last month that looks like the version that ran the state of Massachusetts fairly successfully. But it's not clear that he would have governed as that president. And I think that people, I mean, now I'm just, I suppose, talking about myself, but I think there was a way in which it was hard to know who exactly was going to be president if he was elected, and that worked against him, even though he has the attributes you're talking about, David.
I have a great lightning round. So I'm going to name various things that happened during the course of the campaign, and we're going to say whether they mattered or not.
Oh, boy.
And why they did or did not matter. The first debate.
Yes.
Mattered.
Why? Someone, quick sentence.
Obama would have killed if he hadn't screwed it up.
But that's crucial. Republicans came home to Romney. I think that you have to be limited about how it mattered.
Okay. The Republican primary campaign with Bachman, Kaine, Santorum, Gingrich.
Huh. Seems like a distant memory. I don't think it really mattered.
Caused Romney to commit one of the original sins of the campaign, which was go to the right on immigration, thereby making it impossible for him to recoup among Hispanics who were a part of Obama's winning coalition.
Yes. Also just made the whole Republican Party seem nutty, like seemed like there was irresponsible. Okay, Benghazi.
Yes, made Obama vulnerable. He handled it.
No,
okay,
it had no
but
effect.
Nobody cared in the end?
Nobody cared. It had no effect on the campaign.
Huh.
To the extent that it had an effect on the campaign, I think it may have rattled Romney in a way that he clearly messed Romney, obviously, and we now know from the inside reports that Romney knew he messed up when they jumped the gun on Benghazi. He then was unsure of himself in that debate when he tried to take the case to the second debate, when he tried to take the case to Obama. I mean, who knows if anybody's actual vote was changed, but in terms of getting in the head of the candidate, I think it did probably get into Romney's head.
Bain ads against Romney in the spring.
Brutal.
Yeah, mattered. Helped define him as out of touch and this scary rich guy.
Crazy rape comments by Aiken et al.
Yes, mattered. Those candidates lost, and it goes to your point, David, that the Republicans seemed like they were on the fringe.
I guess I meant more for Romney. Yes, it definitely mattered for the Senate campaigns. Did it matter for Romney?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The piece that I wrote where I asked undecideds to write in, they thought Romney could handle the economy. The thing that held them back was that he was associated with the party who had people like this in it, and for many of them women, the remarks from those candidates defined the party and attached Romney to that. Yeah, it was a problem.
All right. The selection of Paul Ryan.
I don't think it mattered. Weird.
It neither helped Romney, I believe, lost the first congressional district in Wisconsin. He obviously lost the state, but I mean, Ryan didn't even help Romney win the first district.
Okay, last one. Sandy and Chris Christie plus Sandy.
Mattered. Took Chris Christie away from Romney and gave him to Obama and made everybody think about how the federal government is actually exactly what you want to come knocking on your door in the middle of a huge storm.
My instinct is that it didn't matter. But if you in the exit polls, they asked people, was his performance during Hurricane Sandy important? And the numbers were crazy. They were like 40 some odd number of people said it was important to their decision. And I think some other crazy number of people said that it was decisive in their decision. Maybe all those numbers are people who were already going to vote for Obama and they just chose this as the most ready at hand reason. I don't know. But those numbers are interesting.
All right. Coming up, pot and gay marriage win big. You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson. And this is the political Gabfest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. Pot is now legal, sort of, in Washington State and Colorado. Gay marriage is now legal, definitely, in Maine, Maryland, and Washington State. These are issues that were barely, like, not even discussed 10 or 15 years ago. It's inconceivable 20 years ago that we would have thought, oh, gay marriage is going to be legalized by popular vote in several states. And no one will really blink. No one's really that shocked about it. Emily, why is it that gay marriage first was able to get through on state ballots now after having failed in state after state after state before, or been banned in state after state after state before?
Well, one thing is just that people are getting used to it, finding that there's absolutely no harm to anyone and quite a bit of benefit, and that they are coming to support this because they know gay people who want to get married and are excited about it. And then we ran a good piece this week by Nathaniel Frank making the argument that there was a very targeted, research-heavy effort this time for these ballot initiatives. This was the first time that a state was going to legalize gay marriage outside of the courts through voters. And that what the research showed was that in previous campaigns, the gay rights advocates had gone out and talked about rights and benefits and equality, and that straight people don't really think about marriage in those terms. We've just never had to worry about a right to get married. So we talk about it and think about it in terms of like love and compassion and taking care of kids. So this time around, that was the message from the campaigners for these ballot measures. And that proved to make a big difference. And so, you know, think about what happened in Maine. It was only in 2009 that Maine voters handily voted down precisely the ballot measure that they passed this time. That's an enormous shift that shows that there are both demographic and social forces going on, and also just like a real change in message.
It's kind of amazing. Anna Marie Cox wrote a piece in The Guardian about this, how fast we've traveled. I mean, George Bush in 2004 called a press conference in the White House to announce that he was running basically as a part of his reelection campaign on the idea of a constitutional amendment to stop same-sex marriage. Then in the last several elections, you've had the best same-sex marriage advocates could hope for is that the rights wouldn't be restricted in elections. And now you see them being improved. And also, obviously, we should mention that Tammy Baldwin was elected to the Senate, the first openly gay candidate to join the Senate. And the fact that it never came up as a campaign issue among Republicans, even in their own primary, where they were all on every issue trying to out conservative the other, and then in the general election, not discussed at all.
Well, I think it's because it's a fundamentally conservative issue. Once you get past the kind of
the
fact that
it's
a gayness, I mean, it's like it's conservative. It's people.
Pro-family.
It's pro-family. It's pro-institution. It's very, very, very conservative.
That's sort of if you're non-social conservative. Because social conservatives aren't conservative in that way.
Right. Yeah. So, Emily, one thing I wanted to badger you about, isn't there something troubling about passing laws like these by popular vote? I mean, I know that having judges decide that gay marriage is legal has its own problems, but don't you worry that as the popular vote giveth, so it taketh away, that populism as a form of legislation is very, very dangerous?
So here's my theory about this. What I like ballot initiatives for are simple, straight up and down questions where you can read a sentence and very clearly understand what you're doing. So should we repeal the death penalty in California? No. That was their answer. Should we allow gay people to get married in Maine and Maryland and Washington State? Yes. This is not a technical, you don't have to read a whole paragraph to get it. I'm totally fine with ballot initiatives in that context. And yeah, if people change their minds about things, then this aspect of this right gets taken away. But I'd much rather have it come down this way than through the courts, because then people feel like it's being imposed in this less democratic way. And there is much more chance that it won't, it just won't take socially. Whereas with these ballot initiatives, I think we're past that. And that's why this is a big watershed.
Can I also just throw in another big watershed, that the Affordable Care Act is now, it's in law and it ain't going to get overturned. The president can do nothing in his second term. And he now has a lasting historical legacy.
Yes, yeah, that is clearly, that was the big thing that happened. I agree. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg can safely, like, retire to go be a supernumerary in operas.
Yeah, I wouldn't say she's in a big hurry. She seemed very vigorous to me when I saw her a few weeks ago.
If she doesn't retire before the next presidential election, though.
You could say the same thing about Justice Breyer, who's also in his mid-70s. Let's just point out.
That's a good point. So, Emily, let's also talk about marijuana, pot, Mary Jane, cannabis. So it's legal in Washington and Colorado, but is it legal?
No, because there's still federal law, and federal law controls, and the Department of Justice has not said they're going to turn a blind eye in either state. And in fact, in the last year, there's been a bigger crackdown against medical marijuana dispensaries in California than there had been since California first legalized medical marijuana in 1996. The glimmer of hope on the horizon here for the marijuana initiatives and reformers are that before the 2010 election, when this precise measure was on the ballot in California, Eric Holder came out swinging beforehand. That's the attorney general. He said, "Don't pass it, guys. We're going to vigorously enforce our federal laws, and you're setting up a showdown." And in fact, the measure failed in California. This time around, 9 former heads of the DEA, all these other former federal drug officials, got together, wrote a big letter to Eric Holder, said, "Hey, speak up, say something." And he stayed silent. He did not take a position. So maybe there is some sense in the Department of Justice that this is not where they want to put their resources, going after people who possess, it's an ounce. That's how much you're allowed to have now in Washington and Colorado. And in Washington, I think you're allowed to grow 6 plants. We're talking about really small-time marijuana possession here. And it's possible that the Department of Justice could just decide not to enforce. But that would be really, really turning a leaf for the way the Obama administration's lawyers have been I didn't even do that on purpose, have been thinking about this issue. So there's, to me, it's this fabulously interesting legal experiment and also social experiment. We've never had a state where there was a legal market for marijuana the way there is in Amsterdam. Are they going to tax it? How are they going to regulate it? What's actually going to happen?
Wait, can I ask a question? Are there actual federal marijuana cases for people who have less than an ounce of marijuana? I mean, I can see.
I don't think so. I think that they only bring the bigger cases, but when they do big sweeps and they pick those people up, they hand them over to the state police to prosecute. And there's no notion. There are particular cities where there's been essentially amnesty for having like one joint on the street. But there's never been an official Department of Justice line where we're not going to do the small stuff.
So, John, should they leave it alone? Should they just let people go to Colorado for their stoner vacation?
Well, in the theory that there are bigger fish to fry, and in a world of shrinking resources, by which I mean federal budgetary shrinking resources, it seems to me you want to spend your money, your time on big cases and crimes, and that this is pretty small beer, and you wouldn't waste the time and money going after these people. So, yes, book your stoner vacations to Colorado now if you're not so baked that you forget.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of our show with more topics on our podcast. Search for Slate Political Gabfest in iTunes. I'm David Plotz in Washington, handing the show off to Stephen in New York.
Thanks, David. I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest. On today's program, Flight, the new movie directed by Robert Zemeckis and starring Denzel Washington. And then George Lucas has sold his share of Star Wars, which is John Swansburg, 100% owner of the Star Wars franchise, Way to Look Alive, to Disney for $4 billion. We'll talk about what that means for Star Wars. And then finally, the poetry of hashtags with a very, very special guest, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
How are you?
I'm good.
Good. And filling in for Dana Stevens this week is Slate's editorial director, John Swansburg. Hey, John.
Hey, Steve.
I should say I come fresh from the AMC 25 in Times Square, having just seen the movie Flight. I went into it, John Swansburg, not even knowing what genre the movie was. Well, the only thing I knew about it was that it starred Denzel Washington and was directed by Robert Zemeckis. I come out it was for me a half gobsmack, but we'll get there. I'm really curious to know what you made of this movie.
I'm curious what genre you think it was in. One of the things I liked about Manuela Dargis's review of the movie in the Times was that she's called it a genre sampler. She said it was shifted from thriller to romance to family melodrama to legal drama, and I think that's accurate. And I think some of those modes were more successful than others. I thought the thriller mode, the set piece in which Denzel Washington rescues a plane that's in free fall, was really, really gripping. I will definitely think about it the next time I buckle into an airplane. I thought that the Washington performance and his sort of capturing of alcoholism, specifically functional alcoholism, was really good. He sort of played a character who was able to be a true addict and also someone who was able to fly a plane, which is something I hadn't seen on film recently, at least, if ever. But in sort of generally speaking, I think I was also half gobsmacked and half a little kind of bored in parts, and I didn't love the movie. I didn't truly enjoy it.
Yeah, Julia, I mean, I think John certainly identifies, you know, one of the most distinctive things about the movie, which is that opening set piece, which put me to mind, weirdly enough, of Ian McEwan in a totally different medium, right? McEwan starts the novel Enduring Love with this incredible set piece of a balloon accident and then sets up a whole kind of wrenching emotional story around it. And McEwan's capable of writing like a genre writer, and Zemeckis is, of course, known for directing like a genre director. I actually didn't think of that as a kind of Frankenstein move or a weird move or something that set me up for a melodrama that I wasn't prepared for. I kind of liked it because of that.
So why do we need a lawyer from Chicago?
He specializes in criminal negligence.
Criminal negligence?
Mm-hmm.
Death demands responsibility. 6 dead on that plane. Someone has to pay.
I flew the plane inverted. That means upside down. You have any idea what that's like?
I do. I heard the black box recordings last night.
Oh, you heard? Are you a pilot?
No, I'm not.
Then you don't know what they're talking about. All right, let's cut to the chase. Just tell me what it is I need to know, Charlie.
The NTSB GO team also collects blood, hair, and skin samples. An initial report shows that you had alcohol in your system.
Thank you. So that was... doesn't mean anything. I had a couple of beers the night before the flight.
This toxicology report states that you were drunk. And if it is proven that your intoxication was the cause of the death of the 4 passengers, now we're going to look at 4 counts of manslaughter. That could be life in prison.
What did you think?
I would have liked it if I'd liked the resulting melodrama better. I have to sound a sour note about the current state of the acting of Denzel Washington. I did not love this performance. I thought it was like a little scenery chewing and a little ham-handed and a little, I don't know. I just couldn't quite go there with him. And I also think I was left a little bit wondering. I mean, I realized that last week I endorsed broadcast news and was lamenting the demise of the sophisticated and nuanced adult drama in Hollywood. And now we have seen what is perhaps one director's stab at a sophisticated and nuanced adult drama. I think this was an adult drama, but I don't think there was any nuance to it. If you think about, I mean, if it's fundamentally an addiction movie, dressed up with some fun plane crash footage and a good courtroom scene, I don't think this was a really interesting portrait of addiction. It seemed like a very cliched portrait of addiction, one that was not particularly revealing about what it's like to be an addict, what it's like to love someone who's an addict. I don't know. I felt like the bravura of the opening sequence was terrific, and it made me really excited that Robert Zemeckis had stopped making those really gross, grimy-looking motion capture movies he's been making for the last 10 years and is back in live action. But then I didn't love where it went.
I actually really liked the movie, I have to say, and I thought his performance was extraordinary. In part, I think maybe because I went in not knowing what kind of movie I was going to see. I literally didn't know whether the plane was going to like fly up to heaven and they were going to meet angels, whether it was going to burrow to the center of the earth and they were going to meet, you know, druid monsters. I literally had no clue at all. And so I sort of had to follow it as it unfurled, with no guidance from my own preconception about the movie at all. And I thought it was an extraordinary performance. This is totally subjective, Julia, and you and I are just going to disagree. I thought it was such an interesting portrait of an African-American male, right, who's in what is, I think, traditionally a kind of white male role of authority. And his
the pressures on him to enact that social role. Meanwhile, a deep sense of doom and equivocation lives within him. And I thought the continuity for me came not from the genre of the film, which is quite confused and kind of polyglot, but from that single performance. Like, this is what it is for this man to be walking this particular tightrope. And that I thought was completely effective.
Swans, break the tie.
I mean, I'm a little bit closer to Steve's perspective on that. I think I enjoyed the movie a little bit less than he did, but I really did think that Washington's performance was pretty extraordinary. And I agree with your reading of how the that opening set piece sets the movie off in a really smart way. I think it was really a smart turn to have this pilot save the plane, possibly because he was high on cocaine and still a little drunk from last night. That sort of central piece of complexity, could this guy have done what he did? Would any other pilot have thought to do it or had the balls to do it if they hadn't had the sort of bravura that he sort of acquires from being coked up? Is sets in motion a very complicated moral quandary. Mm-hmm. And like Steve, I also liked the way in which Denzel Washington's character is forever trying to figure out how to tell his own story. And again, I think the fact that he's been so successful for an entire career in telling this lie, this mm-hmm. false story about himself. I mean, he's gotten to this point as a successful captain. He's lost a wife along the way, and he's estranged from his son. But he's been functional enough to fly aircraft all over the country, and no one's ever caught him, and he's never crashed. And, you know, I think that's him coming to terms with his inability at this point to continue telling that lie makes for an interesting story.
But you didn't find it all a bit ham-handed and ploddingly written, like, I choose to drink and Jesus praises and all these, there were all sorts of like references to God and whether you can put yourself in God's hands, and it just seemed like a little clunky to me.
Yeah, I agree with that. They kept referring to the passengers as souls, which maybe is industry speak, but they like did it enough times that we were supposed to think of them as souls and not as people.
I mean it knocked and pinged a little bit, but I thought it also ran with the degree of elan as well. But Julia, let me ask you a question. What did you make of Don Cheadle in this movie? I thought he was amazing in this movie, and I loved the contrasting portraits of Cheadle and Denzel Washington. But that interplay was remarkable.
Don Cheadle was great. He plays this sort of hotshot lawyer who promises to, you know, extract Denzel Washington from some of the thornier questions that John posed about what role his substance abuse played in his ability to execute this daredevil move in this plane successfully. But he's just so fun to see in almost anything. He's really subtle and smooth and quick. And I felt like he was not playing a caricature of himself and of his previous performances. And I liked that. And to me, it showed up some of the things that I liked less about the Denzel Washington performance. I mean, I think this is basically a movie that, for the sake of schlock Hollywood storytelling, glamorizes substance abuse in the name of suggesting that it is emotional drama about addiction. I mean, we're supposed to be excited by the fact that Denzel Washington can roll out of bed with a hot naked chick and, you know, snort lines of coke and do this crazy thing with his plane. I just felt like there was no truth to the second half of the movie, emotional truth.
I guess I just disagree with you, Julia, about the way that those addiction scenes play out. I feel like too often in an addiction movie that Hollywood makes, someone takes a couple drinks at the bar and 2 minutes later they're wrapped around a telephone pole because, of course, if you drink and drive, you always get in a crash. And this movie is not about, the automatic crash that happens when you drink and drive. It's about the fact that you can get away with it for a lifetime sometimes before, you know, it catches up with you.
Well, maybe I'm just can't let up on this movie because I don't want it to supplant Airplane as my favorite movie in the world about a pilot with a drinking problem.
All right. Well, once again, the movie is Flight. It's directed by Robert Zemeckis. It stars Denzel Washington and Don Cheadle, and it's in theaters everywhere. Coming up, the strange poetry of hashtags. You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Julia Turner and John Swansburg, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. All right, well, moving on. About 10 years ago, George Lucas apparently said that Star Wars was finished, was done for the big screen. Nonetheless, here comes news, John Swansburg, that the Walt Disney Corporation has bought Lucasfilm with an obvious eye towards making more Star Wars movies. Apparently, the first installment in a new trilogy is due in theaters in 2015, with episodes 8 and 9 to follow. This is an entertainment story, a business story, a business of entertainment story. What do you take away from this?
I don't know how to feel about this. I am someone who grew up worshiping the original trilogy, watched it over and over and over again, could probably recite, you know, the screenplay for Empire Strikes Back while acting out certain action scenes for you. And I will do that for you later today if you like. So I'm one of these people who loved the original trilogy, died a not entirely small death when the prequels came out that were sort of produced by George Lucas and did not live up to my hopes and dreams. So I'd sort of written off Lucasfilm after the terrible prequels and was sort of happy that George Lucas announced that he wasn't going to make any more movies because at least he couldn't do any more damage. I mean, the prequels were so bad that they weren't even bad on their own terms. They were sort of made the original movies worse, like they're that bad. So in a way, I have to say I kind of greeted this news with some happiness because I'm happy that George Lucas is not going to be involved if there are going to be more movies. And it seemed like a financial inevitability that there would be more movies. There's just too much money on the table for someone not to make these sequels. And so, I don't know. I'm someone who grew up going to Disney World, too. I think some people who are fans of the Star Wars universe greeted the news that Disney was the buyer with some horror. But I actually think that Disney could be well-placed to make a series of movies that were certainly better than the last three that Lucas made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Julia, so which is it? Is it rescued from George Lucas or doomed by Walt Disney?
I think rescued from George Lucas. I mean, there's all kinds of great directors out there who could take the raw material of this and make some kind of compelling movie. They could also make some god-awful, ornate flop, and we'll see which, and either would be entertaining to see and write about, probably. But I don't know. I did not grow up watching these movies and don't share the sense that they are sacred texts which cannot be violated by future sequels, prequels, merchandising, a Cartoon Network animated shows, or T-shirts. It's fine with me. Do whatever you want with these people. Put Han Solo in a McDonald's Happy Meal.
Go. Sacrilege!
Well, no, see, no, the thing is, no fan would ever complain about merchandise. So Lucas's genius stroke was to figure out that merchandise was the future of Hollywood. And I am someone who grew up worshiping the movies as sacred, but also demanding that my mom take me to Child World so I could get the new Han Solo action figure to play with. That's sort of part and parcel with the fandom. It's really just the desecration of the storyline mm-hmm. that I think the fans hate. But I mean, I think the reason, one business reason that Disney put out $4 billion for this is that they're really good at merchandising. And they recognize that if they make three good movies that not only appeal to younger audiences, who I think have continued to be thrilled by even the prequels, but also if they make a good movie that draws back in some of the original fanboys, then they can make a killing with mm-hmm. the action figures. They like I think I would probably buy an action figure for a great Episode 7 character. Maybe.
You are so weird. Would you keep it in the box forever?
Obviously, that's how you preserve the value.
Okay. Anyway, well, here's how I feel about this, since you're dying to know. The other day, I caught some of the original Star Wars on television. And you know the old saw about the freshman who says, oh, Hamlet's so terrible, it's just a tissue of cliches. You know, there are works that give rise to so many tropes and metaphors and visual metaphors that we're now so familiar with that when you go back and read the blindingly original text, you can only see it through all of the things that it spawned, and so it seems quite cliché. I had the exact opposite experience of watching a half an hour, 40 minutes of Star Wars on television. In fact, when you see the original Star Wars, after not encountering it for a while, all of the that it spawned in its wake falls away. And what you see is what he was really trying to do, which is a movie that has, and he said this, it's parts of it are an ode not to Flash Gordon in the old serials, but to David Lean, and very broad, slow, epic, sweeping, melancholy filmmaking. And there's a lot of that in that film that people completely forget. And it's what makes things like the bar scene so magical and so wonderful and so real. It's because he wasn't afraid to put in longer or whatever that word is in between them. And it's actually quite a beautiful and unique and original film. But then, John, what he does is he goes a long way to destroying a lot of goodwill, because when he finally takes the helm of another movie as director again, it's the trilogy, right, the prequel trilogy. And those movies did seem, for someone who didn't need to commercially exploit anything ever going forward again, a man who had the riches of Croesus, they seem strangely crass and manipulative and commercially minded. Why would he do that?
Yeah, I think that is one of the great tragedies of the prequels, and also that he squandered this great mythology that he had created, and a relatively simple one in the original trilogy becomes much harder to follow, far more characters, and it lost some of the kind of Joseph Campbell simplicity that made the original trilogy so great. It's really sad.
But I do think if we've learned anything from the last 20 or 30 years in Hollywood, it's that a few bad iterations of a franchise does not mean that the franchise cannot be reinvented successfully. I mean, I'd be psyched to see what J.J. Abrams did with Star Wars after being so psyched by what he did with Star Trek. And I don't really think the source material is that different from Star Trek. I think Star Wars is great.
Wow.
I hear you. But I don't think, I mean, it's great and glorious and a lovely movie. And it may owe a lot to the cinema of David Lean. But, it's like a schlocky sci-fi franchise. And fun things can be done with it.
All right, well, moving on. The hashtag for the dexterous user is a versatile tool, so writes Julia Turner in the Sunday Times Magazine?
This?
You're the same Julia Turner?
I'm the same Julia Turner.
A human being that utterly dead inside and necrotic soul could write that piece about the hashtag?
I don't know. You'll have to reconcile the two Julias.
I know. Well, all right. Anyway, so the hashtag for the dexterous user is a versatile tool, one that can be deployed in a host of linguistically complex ways. In addition to serving as metadata, the hashtag gives the writer the opportunity to comment on his own emotional state, to sarcastically undercut his own tweet, to construct an extra layer of irony. Paging William Wimsatt and Cleanth Brooks, there's irony and ambiguity, and you make it sound like a T.S. Eliot poem. I have to admit, it's only because I'm dense, because it is a lovely, lovely essay. I still don't know what a hashtag is. Tell me, explain to me.
Oh, Steve, I tried so hard to pitch this piece to both avid hashtag users and New York Times Sunday Magazine reading grannies who are still not quite clear on what this Twitter is and how you send out a twit. But apparently I didn't reach quite as far as you.
No, you didn't. You spell it out really, really, really slowly.
H-A. So a hashtag. So Twitter allows you to send 140 character bursts of text into the world. You're familiar with this, Steve. We did a segment about it several years ago. I know you've at least tried
it. I have an account.
Have they written about it yet in the Partisan Review?
You're playing dumb, Steve. Anyway, hashtag is a convention that arose about 5 years ago on Twitter, which started as a way to classify tweets, basically to tag them, like putting them in a file folder. So if your tweet was about politics, you might put hashtag politics. If your tweet was about fires in San Diego, you might put hashtag San Diego fires.
And does that, for the user, does that then aggregate them in a thread?
Initially, what it allowed people to do on Twitter was they could search for that hashtag, and it would pull up all the related tweets. Eventually, Twitter HQ cottoned on that this is how people were using the pound sign within Twitter. And in 2009, they made hashtags hot, meaning that anytime you typed hashtag San Diego fires or hashtag Steve doesn't use Twitter, that became a hot link. And when you clicked on it, you would pull up all of the different tweets that had Steve doesn't use Twitter as their labeling piece of metadata.
I'm still drawing a major blank here. John, this makes sense to you?
Total sense. I'm an avid Twitter user. So, I used hashtags just this morning.
Oh, really?
And I thought Julia did a fantastic job of putting her finger on what makes hashtags so much fun. I mean, I think there are two ways in which they work. One is that functional use that you described, which can be great. I mean, I think one of the downsides of Twitter is you have a feed and you select who you're going to follow, and your Twitter feed can kind of feel insular. It's like you're listening to the comments of the people that you like or who have sort of made it into your Twitter universe. But when you click on a hashtag, all of a sudden you're seeing what the entire world who's talking about Steve not using Twitter, all of those people, what they're saying.
Now, that makes some sense. So it bursts the little hermetically self-enclosed bubble of your own Twitterverse. And all of a sudden, things are coming to you on a different principle, which is whoever is hashtagging to this.
Yes.
And then you get this other...
It shifts the orientation of Twitter from who you follow to what is being discussed.
Got it. Okay.
At least that was the original use. But one of the things that drew me to write this piece, actually, is that the hashtag has many different subversive and unexpected uses that kind of play with this original metadata tagging function. So this is still the main function of the hashtag. This is what most hashtags on Twitter do. But because of the compression of the space, because you're only working with 140 characters, a lot of the funniest writers on Twitter, I think, are using hashtags in really interesting ways to sort of comment on their own mental states or to crack particularly goofy jokes or just to play with language in a manner that's really witty and interesting and subtle and unusual and not really analogous to any other particular form I think we've seen before.
Okay, I could give an example.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Let's hear an example.
One of the ones I singled out in the piece is by the critic Jesse Oxfeld, who tweeted, "Oh, you know, standing in front of Whole Foods, on the phone with mom, answering her question about how to spell Holocaust, hashtag never misspell," which is a little winking reference to never forget and just kind of goofy. But I think there's also other ways to do it, like the comedian and podcaster Mark Maron, who's been a guest on the show, uses them to signal emotional pathos in kind of a funny and compressed way. I think one tweet was something like, just stuffing cupcakes into my face in the bathroom mirror, hashtag hotel, which gives you like a sad portrait of life on the road. And another one was something like, I hate everything, hashtag treadmill thoughts, which to me is like a portrait of exercise for the ages. And there's a way to, you know, those are very efficient ways to express emotional states. I mean, I think that there is economy and beauty in that language, even if it's kind of just a hacky joke, you could argue. But I think part of the reason that it's worth singling out all of these unusual, unorthodox, less metadata-y ways to use hashtags at this particular moment is that the hashtag has become a major force in the world of branding and marketing. If you read Ad Age or watch television or look at billboards or look at magazines, all kinds of brands and companies have now adopted the hashtag as a major way of trying to get people to latch on to whatever it is that they're doing. And it's a little bit funny because there's a whole population of millions and millions of people who use Twitter and understand what a hashtag is and are psyched and get it when they see hashtag debates on ABC during the middle of the presidential debates. And then there's a whole other population of people who are like, what does the pound sign mean? Where do I put it? Where do I type that? I mean, it's like a whole population of Americans have just learned that you can type in www.something.com and get to a website. And now Twitter is trying to make, quote, the hashtag the new URL. And it's unclear how far they'll get. But
I picture old people like with one of those really like one of those phones with the big numbers, like punching in pound debates, like with the headset being like, what? They're not answering.
Yeah, it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see if it takes off as a main way of aggregating information about brands and products. But it certainly does work. I mean, they're one of the examples that one of the people I interviewed at Twitter mentioned is that after that earthquake during which we were recording in Virginia a few years ago, there were 15,000 tweets in the first 2 minutes about earthquakes. So that was a big impact on the population. When during the NBA slam dunk contest, the network put the hashtag Sprite Slam on screen, there were 50,000 tweets in that same first 2 minutes. So as marketers are using television to kind of promote the hashtag as a branding tool, it's getting a little bit louder on the branding side and a little bit quieter on the quirky humor slash emotional pathos side. So I wanted to speak out for the unexpected beauty and value of the hashtag.
That was one of the questions I left the piece wondering about. Do you think that we are sort of living or have lived in the last 18 or 24 months in the golden age of the hashtag, and it'll sort of disappear as Twitter changes or as corporations kind of co-opt that space? Or do you think that it has enough kind of life in it, enough sprightliness, enough jokes, enough fun, enough functionality that it will persist? It'll be something that we are still talking about in 4 years.
I think it's going to persist, actually, because I think you start seeing it in language off of Twitter. I think people start to use it in writing. I've actually heard people use it in spoken language. I mean, sometimes people will say, like, hashtag I'm so sad, or, it'll start getting incorporated in other ways. I do think there's some risk that, you know, the smartest and cleverest wags on Twitter will think, ugh, if I put a hashtag on this, it'll look like it's a sponsored tweet from Coke or something
right,
like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's enough room to play around that we probably won't see these funnier uses disappearing too soon. And actually, Twitter had some data that suggested that the distribution curve of how people are using hashtags is remaining consistent. So there's still sort of as large a percentage of tweets as ever that have hashtags appended to them that are affixed to only one tweet. So we must assume that those are the glorious and witty tweets and hashtags of Twitter and just go out and find them and retweet them, Steve. I'll be counting on you.
Consider it done, Julia Turner. Whichever Julia Turner you are.
This is at Julia Turner.
Please. All right, Steve. It's endorsements o'clock.
John Swansburg, what do you have?
Can I start with just a personal endorsement for Julia Turner, which is I think you should see this movie Star Wars. And then afterwards you should watch the original Star Trek film, and then next week come back with a 3-to-5-page paper comparing and contrasting them.
To come back next week with a living soul.
But for our other listeners, I don't know anything about opera, but I'm going to endorse an opera, not because I think it's so wonderful to listen to, though I think it's perfectly fine. I don't have enough of a trained ear to say whether it's great or not. I'm sure it is great in its own way. But its mere existence is fascinating to me. I saw this opera a couple weeks ago when I was vacationing in Paris. It was the only opera that was available the night that I had free time, which is why I chose it. And then only later did I realize it's Providence. So the opera is A Rake's Progress, which is the music is by Igor Stravinsky, but the libretto was written by W.H. Auden. And the story was based on William Hogarth's etchings of the same name, A Rake's Progress, which sort of follows the dissolution of a young man when he goes to London. And just that collaboration between Auden and Stravinsky, the fact that it even happened was surprising to me and interesting. And it's in English, so it's a little bit more approachable for opera non-opera buffs. You can actually understand what they're saying most of the time. And it's an interesting listen. And just if you're a fan of the work of any of those people, seeing it all come together is sort of fascinating.
Yeah, I've never seen it. That's a great endorsement.
My recommendation is a song. The song is called In a Big City. The band is Titus Andronicus. And it sounds like what the Pogues would sound like if they were from New Jersey in the early 90s.
Hashtag.
That's not a hashtag, Steve.
He still doesn't get it.
Tweet.
You can't just say a hashtag.
If you just start interjecting tweet between sentences, Steve, it's going to make you a much less compelling podcast host.
Are you done?
Yeah.
That's it?
I'm trying to keep it pithy.
All right. Well, this week this is a bit of a recycle job, but it comes to mind because of the George Lucas story and the facile comparison to Star Trek. But my all-time favorite movie in the space genre remains Galaxy Quest, the comedy starring Tim Allen, which sends up that whole genre. So, I mean, it really sends up Star Trek more than Star Wars, but it just sends up that genre and that particular franchise so lovingly and so beautifully. And it has, as with all things, it's totally ennobled by the presence of Alan Rickman. It's so terrifically funny and absolutely gets it. What makes people so obsessive about these kinds of movies and what itch they scratch? And it's so flawlessly done. It's so terrific. I couldn't recommend it more highly. John Swansburg, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Julia, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
And I should mention that Dana Stevens will be back next week joining us on the panel once again. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's show at wnyc.org/gabfest. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows in the iTunes store. Just search for Slate Podcasts. Our email address is gabfestradio@slate.com. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Mike Voilo and Dan Pashman. Our interns are Jeff Friedrich and Sally Tamarkin. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For David Plotz and the rest of the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll see you next week. And some